We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hamilton Today here on 900 CHML. Scott Radley in for Scott Thompson today. Scott will be back tomorrow. Glad you're along with us, though. We have got an absolutely jam-packed, news-filled, breaking news-infused show today. There is a new Ipsos poll out that was done for Global News, and man, I don't know how you interpret this as anything other than an indictment of our medical system, which, you know, for the longest time, how many years was it that we here in Ontario and Canada, when we would talk to our friends from the States, would lord it over them and boast about our free, quote-unquote, free healthcare and our system that was so much better? Well, this new poll now says that 42% of us would go to the United States and personally pay for more routine healthcare if needed. That's up 10% in a year. 38% say they would travel to the U.S. to pay for emergency care, which is up 9% from last year. Again, this poll was done by Ipsos. Sean Simpson is the Vice President of Ipsos Public Affairs. He joins me now. Sean, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
I appreciate you doing this, and I appreciate you doing this poll. Do you interpret it any differently than I do, that this is a slap at our system?
No, not really. And that 5-point decline, 55% of Canadians say that the healthcare system is good. It's a 5-point decline from last year, but a 17-point decline from 2020 when we were in the thick of the pandemic. Of course, Canadians were rallying around our healthcare providers, the healthcare system, and assessments were more positive. In the post-pandemic world, we've obviously begun to see how threadbare the system is, and those fibers are continuing to unravel before our very eyes.
And I wonder, and I don't know that you asked this question, and I don't know that you needed to ask this question, but I actually wonder, of the 42% who say they would go, how many who weren't in that 42, if they were better off financially, might have also joined that. I mean, there's some people who naturally are going to say, well, I couldn't afford to do that, so I'm going to say no. I bet you the number might actually be higher if everybody had the dough to do it.
I'm thinking that sort of 42% number is a little bit optimistic because we didn't, you know, attach a price tag to it. And I don't know if people fully appreciate it, exactly how much it does cost, even for, you know, lower risk or routine procedures in the United States when we're used to getting them for free or next to free in Canada. What is very interesting, though, is that the proportion who say that they would go south of the border is significantly higher among those under the age of 35. So young adults who don't have the money that boomers have, but also apparently don't have the attachment to the public healthcare system that boomers have either.
And that is actually surprising to me. I thought the number would have been much bigger in the older group that had the money to do this. So there you go. There's a twist on it. 79%, according to this poll, support the expansion of virtual care service. And I wonder, again, if that is just people becoming more and more comfortable with doing more and more things online rather than simply looking for an easier way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they see it as a way of making the system more efficient. You know, we got used to doing things online over COVID, but what it also means is that I can sit here in Kitchener and be connected with a specialist in London or Toronto or Vancouver, or people who are living in remote places have greater access to services from bigger cities. So I think it's easier for many people. Yes, they may be able to see more patients that way, but ultimately it bridges geographies, which should in theory create a more equitable system regardless of where you live.
One of the really interesting, and again, I know this isn't exactly what you were looking at in the poll, but, you know, oftentimes we hear, well, we need to spend more on healthcare. And I wonder if people have almost changed tune a little bit, because Canada per capita spends among the highest on healthcare of any country in the world. And yet our results clearly are not satisfying a whole lot of people here. And I wonder if we've almost changed our attitude to say it's not just about let's get governments to spend more and more and more money. The system is not right as it is. It requires a bigger change than just cash being dumped on it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why a majority of Canadians, actually 58%, believe that, you know, if the feds give the provinces more money, there should be strings attached, meaning that they need to declare where they're going to spend that money and show that it's making a difference in the system. And the other thing in this poll, which I think underscores your point, is the rising degree of support we have both for private delivery of publicly funded health services, which we already have a lot of here in Ontario. And I think people are starting to realize, oh, like when I go to the blood clinic, you know, that's actually delivered by a private company in many cases, but still funded by the government. But many would go so far as to say that they support private health care for those who are able to afford it, 63%, up 3 points from last year. And that's actually steadily been on the rise over the last number of years, because people can't imagine or understand, you know, what the solution is. The system is obviously not optimal, and many would argue that it's broken and needs sort of a fundamental examination of how it can become sustainable. And for many people, that sustainability comes from people paying to access services.
Well, I wonder now, and I said this now, I think the third time, and I know this is not exactly what you're able to talk about, but I do wonder now if all these people are saying, I would go to the States to pay, if as you, and then you look at number 63% say they would support private health care, if there's enough softening here that governments would listen. Because to this point, it's almost been a sacrilegious thing to, with any seriousness, suggest, you know, you're right, Life Labs or whatever, you can go get blood taken or get an x-ray, but for anything really big, we would never allow that. That's just such a sacrilegious thought. I just wonder if that's softening enough that a government would say, huh, okay, let's give this a go.
Yeah. Well, it definitely looks like it is. And in places like Alberta, they're further along in that discussion, and support for elements of privatization is higher. And I think if you were to say we can offer private services that don't jeopardize people's ability to still access essentially government-funded services, then people don't have a problem for that. It's sort of like the 407, right? If I decide to take the 407, I pay to be on the 407, and in fact, I'm not on the 401 in everybody else's way as a result. So if we could figure out, you know, how a healthcare system alleviates pressure on the publicly funded system without taking away support and services from people who still use that system. Go ahead.
No, Sean, I think you just nailed the best, clearest example or explanation that people can understand, because this has been what a lot of people have said all along. Private healthcare is not about just giving better care. Now, some people will argue this, but if all the people who will now pay their own way get off the 401 and go on to the 407, it actually makes the 401 potentially go faster too.
Well, that's the theory. The idea here is that if in a private system, presumably doctors who fulfill their quota in the public system can be entrepreneurial and work more privately, and the idea is that might attract more healthcare professionals, you know, because unless we do that, we won't be able to support two streams. I think that's pretty clear. But the number one reason why Canadians give the assessment of the healthcare system right now that they do is because of lack of doctors and nurses. And so if we can make the system more appealing for more doctors and nurses to enter the system, that's a good thing.
Sean Simpson, VP of Ipsos Public Affairs. Very great discussion. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
You've heard a lot. I have no doubt you've heard a lot in recent days and weeks and months, maybe years, about AI, artificial intelligence, whether it was months ago when ChatGPT came out and everyone was doing that. I mean, it goes way before that. Recently, last week, the week before, there was an awful lot of talk about Google and its Gemini AI that was just, man, did it ever get torn apart online for some of the things when you would ask it questions that seemed so much of what was on there was political rather than purely objective AI. Well, now it's going even beyond that, because we are seeing, I mean, not me, but experts are seeing examples of people using really advanced AI to pull off scams. For example, according to a story we're reading today, in one case in Ontario, a guy was convinced to give up $8,000 when AI was used to mimic the voice of his friend on the phone. That was from CTV News. CBC tells the story of how eight people gave up $200,000 when AI mimicked the voices of their grandchildren needing help. And in Hong Kong, there was one where they used AI to create video images of coworkers on a Zoom call, convincing an employee to hand over documents or passwords or something. Well, let me bring on Jonathan Anderson. He's an associate professor and cybersecurity expert at Memorial University in Newfoundland. Jonathan, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I am well, although when I hear this, I realize I like to think I'm discriminating and try to be careful about stuff. But man, we're at the point when if you can't believe anything, man, that's a tough place to be now.
It is. It's been said that we're not ready for a world in which you can fake anyone's voice or fake anyone's image, but that's the world we're in, whether we're ready or not.
So so some of the people listening are probably doing or thinking what I'm thinking, which is, how do I even begin? It's one thing, and we're dealing with something here in the city of Hamilton right now with a cybersecurity breach where we don't know yet how it happened, but you know, it could have been some employee who pressed on a button on their email and opened something. We don't know. That's one thing. But if it's to the point where we're talking to our grandchildren on the phone and it's not really our grandchildren, that's tough. That is really tough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so the number one thing that I think people need to remember is that just as we've learned not to believe everything you read, not to believe every picture that you see, not to believe every, every article that you read online, we also now need to learn not to believe everything that we hear or see with our eyes.
And you can only imagine where this goes. I mean, we're talking about scams, but someone goes in front of a judge or a jury and there's video evidence of them committing a crime and they simply say, that's not me, that's AI generated. The chaos this could create is unbelievable.
So, I mean, I think that's why when evidence is taken in, actually, in some ways, they're less interested in looking at the evidence than they are looking at how that evidence got there and the chain of custody and all that kind of thing, because I think the legal system is wise to the fact that a lot of things can be faked. It's just that it used to be very expensive to fake things, and now it's very cheap and commodified, and anybody can do it with $5.
And apparently do it very convincingly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've had some fun talking to some journalists here locally in Newfoundland, and we have generated samples of a local radio personality announcing how it was cloudy with a chance of meatballs and that kind of thing. And it was literally a commercial service. You don't have to be an expert in these things anymore. You can pay $5 a month or 80% off on your first month and generate whatever text you like in the voice of whoever you have samples of.
I am talking to Jonathan Anderson, associate professor at Memorial University, correct?
Yes, that's
not an AI generated copy of that. But I mean, but that's the thing now. We called you, so we know who you are, but it creates that much doubt now that I could be talking even to somebody I know and not know that they're really the person I know.
Yeah. So I think in the case that you mentioned earlier about the thing in Hong Kong, there was somebody who had responsibility for finances and he got an email that sounded a bit suspicious. And he said, I'm not going to like make this fraudulent payment. Obviously, it's a fake. But then the next thing you know, the chief financial officer of the company and his boss and, you know, other people in the company who had the authority to tell him to do stuff, they said, well, let's do a Zoom call so that you know it's real. Except it wasn't real. Everybody in the Zoom call was fake, and he ended up transferring something like millions of dollars.
It almost is taking us back, is it not, in a full loop, weird kind of way, that once upon a time, you would never do anything except like money-wise, unless you went to a bank and dealt with a teller or someone. We may almost be heading back to where you have to deal with people face-to-face to trust it.
If you're dealing with people, I think that's probably true. Now, I think the security technology that goes into like online banking and stuff is actually very, very trustworthy. And so I would absolutely do my online banking from the app on my phone, in a coffee shop, public Wi-Fi, whatever. That's actually very good. But anything that involves, for a bank, knowing your customer, things like that, I think there is no substitute for a human being turning up in your office.
What would you say in your mind, and it's only a guess, But would be the likelihood? We have a U.S. election coming up, and following that, we're going to have a Canadian federal election at some point. What do you think the chances are that at some point there is going to be video of one of the candidates saying or doing something completely outrageous that we later find out is AI, but has the ability or the likelihood of swaying people's minds on somebody?
So I think it's almost guaranteed. It wasn't video, but AI-generated content has already been used in the U.S. election. There was a case, I think it was in January, in one of the U.S. states in the lead-up to a primary where somebody produced a robocall using fake Joe Biden voice telling voters not to go vote or something like that. We in Canada have our own experience with robocalls, but imagine if that was AI-generated in the voice of your opponent. I think it's almost certain that it's going to happen.
Yeah, and we heard, and this was, I don't know how long ago, a fake Justin Trudeau interview on the Joe Rogan podcast. He was not on the Joe Rogan podcast, but where he said some outrageous things that wasn't him. But my goodness, if you were on social media, there were a lot of people who were believing this, and that's the problem. It's eventually it gets debunked, but what is the damage that's done prior to the debunking?
For sure. And I know that in some parts of the world, they've been extremely proactive about not just tutting at disinformation, but being very proactive about getting real information out to people. I think in Estonia, they have a rule of something like when a government department sees misinformation about their department, they have 2 hours to put out something that's real. I'm not sure that Canadian governments would necessarily be good at putting out information in 2 hours, but boy, what a good target that would be. But the other thing is that when newspapers started introducing pictures, it was interesting. People would sometimes apparently say things like, oh, you can't believe everything you read, but if there's a picture, it must have happened. Of course, we don't all feel that way anymore because we've learned about Photoshop and we've learned that pictures can be faked. And if you saw a picture of, to go back to the example you used, Justin Trudeau in a boxing match with Joe Rogan, you'd probably say that's not real just because we have experience with Photoshop. And I think we need to learn to put on those kind of skeptical glasses when we consume other kind of content now as well. It's not so much about does the picture look right or does the audio sound right or does the video look right? The question is, how am I getting this? Who's it coming to me from? And are they a trustworthy source?
That is Jonathan Anderson, associate professor and cybersecurity expert at Memorial University in Newfoundland. Jonathan, thank you for this.
Thank you.
You've heard lots in the last little while about businesses having to pay back money that they got during the pandemic that they had been given to carry them through. The SEBA loans, you know, those ones. Well, now we're getting to tax season and more people who got CERB money who, it turns out, I guess we're not eligible for it and are now being told you've got to pay it back, are speaking out and saying, how am I supposed to do this? I thought I was eligible. I don't have $19,000, $25,000, $30,000. What am I going to do? Let me bring in Jay Goldberg. He is the Ontario Director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Jay, how are you today?
Doing well. Great to be with you.
Do you have, and you too, thank you for doing this, do you have sympathy for the people who are finding themselves in this position? Is this their fault or is this the fault of the system and the government and the way the program was done?
I largely blame the government and the system and the way the program was done. Look, they gave out $4.6 billion worth of payments to folks who were ineligible. The government sent over almost 400 people who are in jail got those payments. Millions of dollars went to dead people. I mean, look, here's the bottom line. When COVID started and they started up this benefit, of course, this was a rush situation. This is something the government felt they had to get out the money out the door quickly. And so perhaps you can give them some leeway for the first month or two or even three that the program was being run if it went to some folks who weren't supposed to be getting it. But after that, the government really has to do their work, do the job, and figure out who is actually eligible and who isn't. And so you're talking about some people, as you mentioned, who got $19,000, $25,000. And to put that into context, that's several months that you would be on this program, but ineligible for it. So perhaps you can give the government a little bit of leeway for the first couple months where maybe $2,000-$4,000 went out to these folks. But if we're talking about, a year or more, I don't see how that can be laid at the fault of taxpayers. These are individuals who thought they were eligible. The government should have known better, and the system should have been fixed within 2 to 3 months of beginning.
So what should happen now then? Because whether it was the government's fault or not, these people, a whole lot of people, are now being told, you've got a lot of money to pay back, and a lot of them are saying, I can't. Is it, I mean, it's not technically their money, it's the taxpayers' money, and not everyone should be getting a windfall. On the other hand, if it was the government's fault, it does seem kind of unfair now to say, we're going to bankrupt you to get us to get this money back.
Right. So I think there's a couple of questions. One is the time frame. How quickly does it have to be paid back? What kind of interest are we looking at? The other, though, is to think of the broader issue, which is the tax burden in this country. You know, every taxpayer here, you work January to nearly the end of June for the government before you start working for yourself. Government spending is $100 billion higher this year than it was when the government first came to office in 2015. So I think a fundamental issue here is that Canadians are overtaxed. 50% of Canadians are $200 away from not being able to pay their bills. So of course you're going to have people say, we can't pay back $5,000, $19,000, $25,000. Of course, people don't have that lying around. So one of the fundamental things the government has to do is leave more money in taxpayers' pockets and then find a structure that, yes, over time these individuals will gradually pay the money back. But again, because the government was so incompetent and didn't figure out, for example, that someone was on it for a year or more, got $19,000, $25,000, $30,000, as you mentioned, that's something that's the fault of the government. If the individual thought they were eligible, I agree with you that the money does have to be paid back because ultimately this is taxpayer dollars that they shouldn't have gotten, but it's incumbent upon the government to do the right thing and make sure that folks are able to do that over time because it was the government's fault that this occurred.
One other thing that struck me the other day when we heard about the announcement of the PharmaCare program, PharmaCare is going to have to get put together quickly because I think we probably believe that if it's not up and running before the next election, Pierre Poilievre would probably kill it off right away. So they're going to, NDP and the Liberals are going to want to get this thing up and running. All I could think was back to CERB when they said, well, we had to do this giant program really fast. Well, here we now have a giant program starting up and going to be done really fast. What could possibly go wrong, Jay?
Virtually everything. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that, look, a number of organizations have put out a lot of data that shows that there are a lot of Canadians who have private coverage through work or that they've purchased that is better than what the government could possibly be offering through single-payer PharmaCare. And so you need to have conversations about patching up the system, trying to make sure that those who are vulnerable are potentially covered through some other mechanism. But look, at the end of the day, the government is running a deficit of well over $40 billion. We cannot afford a massive new PharmaCare program, let alone a program that could lead to millions of Canadians getting worse coverage because the government wants to do it a single-payer way. And so, as you said, CERB, it was, again, that was an emergency. The government didn't correct course after 2 or 3 months of doing something wrong. This is not some kind of emergency, PharmaCare. This is something that's been on the agenda for decades. And if you're going to try to find a system to try to get some individuals who need it the most more coverage, you should be doing that gradually with a lot of evidence-based research and rolling it out over a period of time when we can afford it.
Yeah, we got
to
run.
To do it the way they're doing it.
My concern is we can have a debate all day and talk about whether the PharmaCare program is good or bad. Some will feel one way, some will feel another. My concern is this is going to be done really fast, and we're going to see giant, cumbersome bureaucracy. And years from now, we're going to be talking about how much money has been wasted. That's my concern. Jay Goldberg, always appreciate you coming on. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
This new Ipsos poll that is just out says 42% of Canadians say they would be willing to travel to the States and personally pay for more routine health care as needed, and 38% of Canadians say they would go to the States and personally pay for emergency care. Both those numbers up considerably year over year. I want to bring in Dr. Sean Whatley. He's a practicing physician. He's the author of When Politics Comes Before Patients, Why and How Canadian Medicare is Failing. He's also a senior fellow with the McDonnell Laurier Institute. Dr. Whatley, thank you for this today.
Thank you.
You know, we were talking about this last hour, and the thing that just jumps out at me when I see these numbers is there has been for a long time this almost religious dogma in this country in many corners that we will not accept any kind of private health care. That is horrendous. That's a thought we should never entertain. And yet now we're looking at 4 out of 10 Canadians, almost 5 out of 10 Canadians, almost half of us saying we would be open to something like this. What has changed?
Well, I'm not sure anything has changed. And it's terrible to disagree with the host on it, but I'll push back a tiny bit. Before the pandemic, 2017, Second Street put out a study. They looked at StatsCan data and found that 217,500 Canadians had left Canada for care. Fraser Institute had a similar study the year before. They were just under 100,000 patients leaving Canada for care. There's a book out called Medical Tourism, Surgery for Sale, How to Have Your Surgery Abroad Without It Costing Your Life. And that was in 2016. I could go on. But on top of that, and this is what really rankles me, is that our politicians have been leaving Canada for care. So Premier Danny Williams, Belinda Stronach when she was in Parliament, Jack Layton went to private clinic, Quebec Premier Robert Bourassa, and Jean Chrétien used the government aircraft twice in 1999 to visit Mayo Clinic. So this has been going on for a long time, decades even. And what's really frustrating for me is that our politicians are the ones that take advantage of it, along with a bunch of other Canadians.
Okay, so you are, by the way, you are always more than welcome to take issue with the host. The host is allowed to be taken issue with, but it does. Okay, so do you agree, though, that there is this, I don't know if it's a consensus, there is this sense within this country that it would be horrendous. What you've just said, I believe wholeheartedly, but probably many of those same politicians or their adherents would say that should never be done. We need to have only public health care in this country. There seems to be this contradiction almost.
Yeah. And part of my pushback was just to make for some excitement. Hopefully we can get into an argument here, maybe, but I'm not sure if we can
arrange that.
But the issue for me, now you brought up the there seems to be a change in the sentiment. So people are willing to actually talk about it. But the frustrating thing, if you listen to Mark Holland, Federal Health Minister Mark Holland's comments on this, I think Global News reported this, and quote, he said this creates a quote, terrible malady for our system. And then he went on and said, quote, a circumstance we cannot allow, end quote. And I just find this is so heartless. I mean, we have BC just last fall sending their cancer patients to the United States to get treatment. And so on the one hand, we have systems in place where we're actually sending our own patients out of Canada to get care. But if you do it on your own, that's really bad. In fact, an associate deputy minister of health in BC in 1995 said, quote, if we could stop them at the border, we would, end quote. And so for me, it's kind of this heartless duplicity that's going on. And I'm really glad that Canadians are finally waking up to say, hey, you know what? People who can, they go. But so why can't we go? And so I'm glad that people are opening up their minds to that discussion.
Well, it does, even though, again, what you're saying, of course, is 100% true that this has been going on. We don't say this with anything else. I mean, we have Canadian Airlines, Air Canada, WestJet, whatever, but we don't say you should only fly the Canadian Airlines. We don't say you can't pay extra to go to private school. We, like in any other area of this country, of our lives, we open the door and say, if you want to pay extra out of your pocket, don't come to us, but if you want to pay extra, knock yourself out. This is the one that seems to get people's backs up in some cases.
Oh, absolutely. And part of it, I say that there are actually two Medicare systems. There's the one that we all dream about that will be there for us when we get sick. And then there's the one that doesn't exist when we actually do get sick. So only 4% of a population in any given area will need to be admitted to an acute care hospital. So most of us, you know, we go to see the doc, get our blood pressure pills or our kid's twisted ankle looked at, and we're really happy, right? We think, awesome, we got this beautiful system that's going to be there for us when we get sick. But when you actually do get sick and someone says, hey, you got a lump in your abdomen, we need to get a CT scan, and you're told it's weeks later, or sometimes even months, or 27.7 weeks now, referral to specialist waiting time, according to the last Fraser Institute study on this. That's when that small percentage of the population who really needs serious care starts to get really worried. And we basically were failing on our promise to provide care for them.
We only have a minute. And we were talking about this last hour, and a guest who was on was using the example of, this is kind of like everybody is jammed up driving in rush hour on the 401. And then a bunch of people decide, you know what, I want to get things done quicker. So I'll pay to go on the 407. They do get to go faster, of course, but also it frees up more space. So those on the 401 also get to move more quickly. Is that a reasonable comparison to what would happen if we did have privatized healthcare or more private healthcare?
Absolutely. And they've done studies in Saskatchewan showing that if you do a one-for-one plan where you do one publicly covered CT scan and then one privately paid for CT scan, you decrease the waiting lists on both sides. So there are solutions, and we're simply ideologically opposed to any of those discussions. That needs to change or people won't get care.
Dr. Sean Whatley, he is a practicing physician. He's the author, go look it up, When Politics Comes Before Patients, Why and How Canadian Medicare is Failing. He's also a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute. Really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Well, the city was having an update, or was giving an update. The mayor and the city manager were doing an update earlier this hour, and it is now done. And listening in on this was Ken Mann from our newsroom, who joins me now. Ken, how are you?
I'm good, Scott. How about yourself?
I am so curious and so eager, because this has been going on now for 8 days. Information has been sparse to non-existent,
sparse would be a good word,
to
yes.
The point that the Twitter poll today here on 900 CHML, it has been asking people about whether the city has been doing a good or bad job with their information they've been giving out. And 91% of people say they've been doing a bad job. So
it's pretty one-sided.
Did they say anything today that is going to make people feel more informed?
Well, I think so. There's a little more information here. I wouldn't say that we have great knowledge of what's going on, certainly. It continues to be the insistence that they have to maintain certain information due to protect the
sure.
city and the residents, frankly.
But I think there were two big questions that people probably had. I mean, I don't want to say that nobody cares about HSR service. I think they do care about schedules on that stuff, but not everyone. I think the one
And if I can anticipate your questions, yes. I'm going to say we have one answer.
Okay.
And we have one half to 60% answer.
Okay. So the first one, which you were going to anticipate, we heard Jen say it, this is a ransomware attack.
That's right. And there is confirmation now that this is, in fact, a ransomware attack. Further detail on that, they're holding back. We don't know how much the perpetrators of this have demanded from the city or what.
Do we know how it got in? Do they know how we got? Did they say that it was a firewall breach
get that sort of detail. No, we don't know where the hack came from either.
Yeah.
We do know the police have been notified. I think we may have known that before, though. So, so we do know it's a ransomware attack. Beyond that, we don't have a whole lot of information on that.
And what about my data, your data, everyone's listening data? Because the city does have information about us that we wouldn't necessarily want everyone to know. Do we know whether that's safe?
Yeah, and I think you've hit on the key point there. And this is where I'm going to say we have most of an answer,
okay.
because they don't believe people's personal information or data has been accessed, and they've committed to working to keep it that way as they fix this situation. Wording being key there, they don't believe personal information or data has been accessed. So that's not a no, but that's we think not. Take that for as much security and confidence as you will.
See, neither you nor I are IT people. And so I sit here and I go, 8 days in, how do you not yet know what is or isn't tapped into? Now, I'm sure there's an explanation for that. I'm sure somebody out there listening would say, well, 8 days isn't all that long or whatever. But so it's at least some comfort level that is going on. There have been other things, though, that have been affected by this, right? Like payments for city employees. there's T4 slip. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's still tied up.
Well, I think a lot of things are basically in a manual payment stage, right? Anything, any sort of online business, to my understanding, has been temporarily halted. So, in fact, there was a good point here where some people are just being allowed to go into swimming, for example, without paying at this point, because that's really the only option there, from what I understood. They're trying to be understanding of residents and the challenges that this is putting on them as it goes forward is really the message that was delivered through this update today.
We are, our family got our latest tax bill the other day, a week or so ago. I'm not sure. My wife does all that, thank goodness. But I know that it arrived. Did they say anything? Do we know, can the city do business? Is the city capable of cashing checks or taking money? I know I saw a sign at City Hall that was posted saying we can take checks or cash, but most people aren't walking down to City Hall with a bundle of cash to pay their tax bill. Like, does the city have the ability to function as a financial institution at this point?
I mean, that's a big question. I don't really have.
They didn't say anything about that today.
To that, but as I said, my understanding is if you're doing your business online, probably not at this point is my understanding, but I'm not saying that with a level of
knowledge,
keeping in mind that I am certainly no IT professional either. So any sort of manual payments or anything like that are where it's at, I believe, for most things at this point.
This is neither here nor there, but I must say there is one person in all of this. I mean, there's many people, I guess, but there's one person in all this that I do feel badly for. And that is Marnie Kluckey, the new city manager, who started in her new job.
What, second week, I believe.
Yeah, second or third week.
Yeah.
There's no reason to believe it's got anything to do with her. She just walks in and all of a sudden has this landmine under her feet. This is quite, I don't know that any city manager has ever started a new job like this.
Yeah, what a first month, right? Yeah, that crosses my mind every time she talks to, because it's just, what a situation to walk into. And,
I can't imagine.
I guess it'll be restored when it's restored. And as they made the point today, they'll do so when they're confident it could be done safely and securely. And that continues to be the buzzword from City Hall, is that they're working to do that for protect residents as much as they can at this point, I guess.
Did they say anything about, are they scheduling now regular updates, or is it going to be updates as warranted, or did they say anything about what we'll hear next?
There was no mention of that whatsoever.
It is, as I say, one of the things about this story that it's been a slow burn, I think, for people in the community, because at first, again, if it's just times for rec centers or HSR buses, I think a lot of people are like, well, okay, I can live without that. And then it starts to drag on. And then I think people start to get more concerned about some of the stuff. So I'm glad they finally came out and said something.
Well, some of that's the timing too, right? Because you just approved the budget and tax bills just coming due. So the timing, not perfect, but then the ransomware attackers know that too, I suppose. So maybe that has something to do with it. I really have no idea.
One more thing. Did they say anything, and maybe you answered this, but did they say anything? Do we know where the ransomware attack originated? Is
No.
it in the country? Is it in City Hall? Is it in another country? Do we know anything?
They did not get into that. That question was asked.
Okay.
And that information was either not known or held back.
That is Ken Mann. Appreciate you doing this. Ken Mann from the 900 CHML Newsroom was in on this one. If you are a fan of theater, if you ever go to Theater Aquarius, you might be pleased with some news today. Monday. So tomorrow, I'll figure it out. Tomorrow, Theater Aquarius is going to be accepting a grant to help with its technology infrastructure, make the place better for plays and other productions. A guy who is behind this, or partially behind it, Neil Lumsden, is Member of Parliament for Hamilton East Stoney Creek. He is also Minister of Tourism, Culture, and Sport. Joins us now. Neil, how are you?
How are you, Scott?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm on your show. I mean, it's the highlight, man. I'm almost wrapping the day up. A few more hours and I can go home and say I was on your show again.
Well, a few more hours, I guess, to get the speech ready for tomorrow's announcement for this presentation. Why Theater Aquarius? Why? I mean, I know there must be endless requests for money. I know there are endless requests to the government. Everybody applies for grants and things. Why Theater Aquarius?
Well, I'll back up the truck a little bit. You're right. The government provides Ontario Trillium Foundation through our ministry to, I'll call them, I almost want to call them impact opportunities within communities. And this is a great example. And, you know, upwards of 448 nonprofit organizations have been the beneficiary of OTF's work and our support. And I think what it comes down to, and, you know, Theatre Aquarius has been the beneficiary of, since 2018, of, I think, just under 1.8 million. And what happens is these opportunities allow them, and in this case, it's a matter of increasing their ability on from a technological side of things and allow them to be better and more efficient. You know, they have been making and will continue to make a huge impact in our community for so many different reasons. You know this as well as I do. But when you get an opportunity to help them be even better and continue to have that impact in the community, it's a wonderful opportunity for us. And we love to see them use the dollars as they do to good use.
Does the, I hate to use the word, but I'm going to, and I hope people and you will understand, does the quality of the place that applies for a grant matter? I mean, I think most people who have been to Theatre Aquarius know what it's all about. And it's, you know, it's a high-end theater that services a higher end of play or concert or whatever else. Does that have an impact on who gets this kind of money?
I think the better way to look at it is those that are successful in their grant application and ultimately show and show the impact it's going to have based on where the money's going to go within the organization. And then the next step is how it will affect and positively affect whomever they are, and in this case, Theatre Aquarius, to continue to be stronger or to get stronger within their community, because it really is soup to nuts. It's not only about the arts. It's about many different things when it comes to funding from OTF. So I would say, no, it's not only how big and strong you are. It comes down to impact and how well you've applied, and I think how you resonate within your community. Some don't get it, and some are could be considered very worthy, but either through application or, listen, not everybody wins, right? So in a lot of cases, there have been some great people out there that may have had it last year but wouldn't get it this year. But, Theatre Aquarius is just continues to do great work, and this will allow them to do even better work.
And again, I mean, one of the things as I read this is the contribution to, and you mentioned it, the contribution to quality of life in a community. How do you measure something like that?
Well, listen, it can be done in a lot of different ways. I think one of the first things is, you know, take a little bit of a sport analogy and apply it. There's over 100,000 people go through a Theatre Aquarius in a year. So right now, they are impacting in many different ways, as sport and culture does, and the arts do, and how it affects people. And the other side of that is the introduction to the arts, whether it's young people, middle-aged, or old. It resonates with everyone differently, but it still resonates with everyone. And I think that's where that ripple effect is felt throughout a community, and they will continue to do it. They're just, because of this grant, they'll be even more efficient from a technological side of things, which will allow them to be better and continue to have great impact within Hamilton. And let's not forget, I'll slide a little tourism in here. When you have the ability to bring people together, whether it's sport or culture or arts, doesn't matter, people will come from certain distances. Maybe people come in from Oakville because they like the show that's going to go on or the play. Those things mean something within a community, because they'll stay and have dinner. They'll hang around. They'll get some gas. And people don't look at that, but that's a big deal when you look at it day after day after day over a period of years. That can be something that can put a small restaurant over the top.
You know, we only have a minute, and I just want to pivot a little bit, because there is another story, and it's got nothing to do with this one, but I want to ask you about it, because it has been one of the biggest and most controversial stories in this city for a few weeks now, and it falls into your riding. It's this parking lot building situation in Stoney Creek. You're the MPP for that area where this is going on. Do you inject yourself into this kind of a discussion, or do you entirely leave this to City Council to figure out?
Well, this is something I'm obviously interested, keenly interested, and I've been paying attention. But this is a responsibility of City Council to get it straight. And you know, you can talk about what we talk about, and that's building more homes. But you have to do it strategically. And I think when it comes down to this, they've got to get together and make some good decisions, as I'm trust they will, around council, and go from there.
So do you support whichever decision they make then, because it was their decision?
I haven't been part of the conversation, Scott, so it's tough to say, well, I support. I have an idea what might be best in that community, given my growing knowledge of our riding. And I'm not sure where they are leaning, but if somebody wants to chat about it at some point, I'm happy to do so.
Well, we have a show every day here on the Chasing, so we may do that soon. We may do that soon, but alas, we are out of town right now, but we will. Neil Lumsden, MPP for Hamilton East, Stony Creek. For Hamilton East, Stony Creek, Minister of Tourism, Culture, and Sport. Really appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the chance, Scott.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
I don't have to say anything when I mention the name Paul Bernardo. You know who that is, and probably still makes your skin crawl. Most of you probably still remember the name Luca Magnotta. He was another real treat. Killed a person, chopped them up, sent body parts, you'll remember, to the prime minister, and got sent away. Well, we've just learned that Paul Bernardo, some months ago, got moved to a medium security prison in Quebec. Now we've learned Luca Magnotta is in the same medium security prison. Some of our absolutely worst, most vile murderers are living in medium security, out of a penitentiary. And I think a lot of people probably are infuriated by this. And I don't know that my next conversation is going to make you less infuriated. Frank Caputo is a member of parliament for Kamloops, Thompson, Cariboo. Recently, he posted, I think today, or maybe it was earlier and I just saw it today, but he took a tour of this facility to see where and how people like Paul Bernardo and Luca Magnotta were living. He joins me now. Mr. Caputo, thank you for doing this.
Oh, thank you very much. Please, Scott, call me Frank.
So tell us about this, because first of all, leaving aside whatever you're going to tell us in a second, I think most people are just outraged that these people are not in a 6x10 cell, period, because we don't really care about rehabilitation for people like these two. But you went for a tour. What was the place like?
Well, it's like a university campus when you first walk in. It's a lot different than maximum security. For those who don't know, I was actually worked in federal corrections before I went to law school and then became a Crown prosecutor. So I know the area very well. And I can say that after 8 years of Justin Trudeau and walking into this and seeing the conditions for some of the most notorious of the notorious, some of the worst of the worst, it was really quite disappointing.
Like what? Okay, so university campus, there's lots of different things. You know, we could have a lot of different views on that.
Okay,
what does this mean?
When you walk in, it's a really open area. You see a number of inmates who are doing inmate jobs going from place to place. So if you took away the razor wire, it would just look like you'd have got a building in front of you, a building to the side of you, another building in behind you. So you essentially walk from building to building or living unit to living unit. In maximum security, it's much more confined. The movements are way more regulated. So there's considerably more movement in medium security. It's a substantial downgrade in security and a huge upgrade when it comes to amenities and personal freedoms.
Like
now,
what?
I think what has outraged most people, what I was surprised to see, is that when I came out of the living unit housing Bernardo, is that there was a tennis court that converted to a hockey rink. And that was probably the first thing that caught my eye. And I thought, how is it possible that somebody like Paul Bernardo, somebody like Luca Magnotta, who walked by me as I was walking outside, I didn't notice him, but someone else did, after the Trudeau government's policies and legislation have allowed people like this to end up in medium security?
I mean, your tweet today that came out, or yesterday, I guess it came out, Canada's most horrific murderers are living better than most Canadians. I mean, is it really better, or is it just really not that bad?
Well, I will say this, Scott. I get letters every day from seniors and young people. I cannot afford a house. I don't have a family doctor. In my riding here, 50% of people don't have a family doctor. People have trouble putting food on the table. People have trouble having a roof over their heads. And they don't have access to a number of the amenities that are there. So a lot of Canadians are telling me they are struggling with their very basic needs. And this isn't to say that people in jail don't have, you know, human rights and access to basic needs. The reality is, though, is that after 8 years of Justin Trudeau, a lot of Canadians can't meet their own basic needs. So when we juxtapose that with this idea that, people in the Bernardo situation or the Magnata situation or others are having all of their needs met, which they have a right to have their needs met, but then and then some, that they're not in maximum security, they're in minimum security because of legislative changes by the Trudeau government, that's going to outrage people, as it should.
Did you get a chance to see, I mean, you mentioned the tennis court slash hockey rink and the buildings. Did you get to see where any of these prisoners live? What's the living situation like?
I did. It's I actually was right front and center in front of Paul Bernardo's cell. I basically was able to look right in there, and it looked like an ordinary cell. Like I said, I used to work in corrections. I've seen a lot of jail cells. It looked like every other jail cell. But what we have to remember is that this isn't every other offender, and yet here he is after 8 years of legislative changes and inaction in medium security, and that's difficult. We actually came face to face at one point.
You and Bernardo?
Yes, but I wasn't in the mood to have a chat. It wasn't the reason for me being there. The reason for me being there was, like you said, to survey the conditions as to how these people are living when they've committed some of the worst crimes.
But the fact that you came face to face with Bernardo, though, I mean, you would have thought that someone who is a inmate like him would have been kept completely away from other, like, it sounds like the fact that a visitor could run into a person like that must say something about the level of security of this place.
Oh, I can actually go one step further. I was watching with the correctional officers, who I thank for their service, because they are supervising some of the worst of the worst. And we can't forget the victims either, who themselves, many of them are living in a psychological, living a psychological life sentence after having been victims to these vile people and their acts. But the correctional officers, they actually have to monitor people that are over their shoulder. And I looked and I said, look, you only have to go up two stairs to get to the landing where the correctional officers sit. And I said, you know what, there should just be a small door there. Like, why isn't there this small door? It's essentially just walk through an opening. I said, why isn't there a door here? And one of the officers said, oh, we asked for one, but corrections said no. And I thought, you know, this is a government where our leader can jet set across the world, go to Jamaica, break ethics violations, and yet we can't even provide our correctional officers with a small door.
One more thing before because we're short on time, and I just want to jump in really quickly, because what about the, if you are in maximum security, as I understand it, your daily freedom is very limited. You spend most of your time in your cell. In this case, is that different? Are you still spending 23, 22, 21 hours a day in your cell, or is there much more freedom to move around within the confine of the space?
There is way more freedom. I was just at a maximum security jail the other day. Way more freedom in medium security in terms of the jobs a person can do, in terms of the living units. This living units there have about 240 people. In the maximum security jails, they might have 24. The eyes are completely different. So we can't forget that maximum security is generally designed for the worst of the worst. And yet, after 8 years of Justin Trudeau, after 8 years of bills like Bill C-83 that says that we should incarcerate at the least restrictive measure as opposed to what is just and appropriate, this is what we're left with. And I think that Canadians have questions and victims themselves have questions. We cannot forget what victims have gone through in this situation.
I'm already late, but I just have to ask, because I know a lot of people are thinking this, and I would be wrong not to. You said you ran into Paul Bernardo. Did he at least look miserable and poor, or was he looking okay?
He looks well nourished, is the way I would put it.
Great. That is Frank Caputo, Member of Parliament for Kamloops, Thompson, Caribou. I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk today. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Scott.
I want to continue the conversation we started with Frank Caputo, who recently took a tour of the institution, the medium security institution, where Paul Bernardo and now Luca Magnotta are both spending their days. Not maximum security, more like a university campus with a skating rink and tennis court and gym and a lot more freedoms, as he described. And just before the break, I said, I just don't understand why we're doing this. I don't understand the point of this. If we have criminals, the worst of the worst, who you would think have zero chance of ever getting parole. I mean, the Parole Board of Canada would not dare give Paul Bernardo parole, I don't think, or Luca Magnotta. I just can't imagine how the system would not implode if they did. What's the point? Let me bring in Ari Goldkind. He's a Toronto criminal lawyer. He's a legal expert, media commentator, joins us now. Ari, how are you today?
Good to be with you, other Scott.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So help me out here, because I get the idea of rehabilitation for maybe even most criminals in our system. But there are a select few that seem to rise beyond the level of what most people would accept under any circumstances to come back into civilization, into society. How are we not able to keep even them locked up in maximum security?
Because we're a very stupid country. That's where the conversation has to start. And you just had on Mr. Caputo, whose video, which when I looked at it today, had about 445,000 views, which is not insignificant. Now, he's the shadow justice minister. You compare that with the justice minister I unfortunately went to law school and graduated with, Arif Virani, who just this week is obsessed with online harms that don't exist, criminalizing speech about his pet issues. You have a justice minister that you just, a shadow justice minister who says, look, why are we having a hockey rink and a tennis court in a medium security campus-like setting for the Bernardos and Magnottas of the world? Now, there are often very good reasons for that, because there are going to be a number of inmates who have paid their debt to society. And the idea is you don't want to make them worse behind bars. You want to give them some glimmer of hope. And you want them to come out into the community on their release date, day parole, full parole, where they're sort of integrated. But we as a country, Scott, and this is an important point that your listeners don't know enough about. Just last week, close to you in London, Nathaniel Veltman was sentenced for the mowing over of that Muslim family of four in one of the most brutal, butcher-like, terroristic, first-degree murder, almost like a serial killing that you can get. Now, you would think that piece of garbage had forfeited his right to breathe the same air as you, Scott, the other Scott, and all of the people listening to you. But the Supreme Court 2 years ago came out and said, no, 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 no. It would be cruel and unusual. Those words are theirs, Scott, not mine. It would be cruel and unusual punishment to prevent even the worst rapist, serial killer, child abuser from being able to apply for parole. This is a country that I think has made a deal with the devil, where it has said openly, and by the way, the Trudeau government can't be faulted for this part of the Supreme Court decision. This was not Trudeau saying he wants this as soft on crime as he and his justice ministers have been. But we are a society, to your original question to me, that simply has said there's nothing so evil, so heinous, that a person can do that they deprive themselves of breathing the same air as you, me, and all of your listeners. And I think in a society where moral blameworthiness, that's the term, moral blameworthiness is what the criminal justice system is all about, if there is nothing you can do that prevents you from dragging the Magnotta victims' families, the Bernardo victims' families, the Picton victims' families to parole hearings in 25 years, then I just think we have lost our way, even as a civilized society.
I'm glad you mentioned the families, because we often hear two things with prisoners like of this ilk. One is that they have to believe they have a chance to be rehabilitated. And on that point, again, my point is if they're never going to get out, who cares and why? But the second one is, well, that's not compassionate or whatever word you want to use. And I'm glad you mentioned the families, because again, if we're talking about compassion, I still can't wrap my head around answering why compassion for the villain, compassion for the criminal would trump compassion for the families and those left behind. I don't understand that.
Well, let's take that to that. Let's continue where you've put that point. So the reason I mention the families is this is what I do for a living. This isn't just some punditry I'm engaged in. I see what these crimes do to families. And I mean real victims. I'm not talking microaggressions. I'm not talking a mean tweet. I'm not talking something criticizing these third rail issues. I'm talking rape, murder, home invasion, carjacking. It ruins lives. And it strikes me that the people that are most soft on crime, Scott, are the people who have never experienced this, who have never had a loved one snuffed off the face of the earth by a piece of human garbage. It's by people who have private security details, Varani, Trudeau, Lametti, people who don't live in the areas that are replete with guns and drugs and crime. So when I say the families, I'm not a bleeding heart. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I defend the Bernardos, the Magnatas. People hear that and they go, Ari, how are these things able to be put together? That's a conversation for a different day. But my point is to your question about the evil is how are we as a society not able to say, look, sure, maybe 95% of people should have a shot at parole, whether it's a long shot or not. It might make them less likely to stab a fellow inmate. It might make them less likely to stab a guard. If you think you have something to live for versus if you don't, it strikes me, by the way, that that's a poor argument. It just means prisons aren't well designed. But is there nothing that you can do in a country that was once law abiding, that was once safe, that was once civilized? None of those things I think apply anymore, where by your own actions, not forced, not dropped on your head as a child, by your own evil actions, you simply, because we don't have the death penalty, Scott, remember, we're not killing them. Where you simply haven't made decisions with a clear mind, where the effect of you getting caught and being punished in a civilized system is simply that you don't get to go to Club Fed and you don't get to drag the families every 2 or 3 years to the Kingston Penitentiary to relive the hurt that they've had, but the people who are making the laws and the rules have never experienced personally.
We got to run, but when I say this, I want to be very careful about this. I do wonder about what you just said about not experiencing this. If back in 2014, when Nathan Cirillo was killed at Parliament Hill and there was a shooter there, heaven forbid if that shooter had got in and killed a bunch of our parliamentarians, that would have been horrendous. Nobody is calling, nobody wants that. I do wonder if some of the lawmakers might have had a different opinion on this, if it had hit close to home. I do not want that. Nobody do that. That's a horrible thought. It's a horrible concept. But I do wonder if we might have seen things, those making decisions might have seen things differently based on what you said about how this is not their world. And thank goodness it's not their world. But Ari Goldkind, I wish we could talk about this for 2 or 3 hours. We can't, unfortunately. Toronto criminal lawyer, legal expert, really appreciate you coming on and doing this. Thank you.
Good to be with you, Scott.
On the weekend now, on Sunday, the Prime Minister was meeting with the Prime Minister of Italy, and that got essentially shut down. The entrances and exits to the Art Gallery of Ontario were blocked now by protest. This is something that we are seeing in cities all over the place. We are seeing this affecting protests that are outside of synagogues now and other things, and yet we don't seem to see a whole lot of action from police. There have been a couple arrests here or there, but is it time for more to be happening? Sean Sparling is a retired deputy chief of the Sault Ste. Marie Police. He's currently the president of the Investigative Solutions Network. Joins us now. Sean, thank you for this today.
Thank you for having me.
Are we at the point where more should be done, or is the right move by police just to stand on the sidelines and not get involved to not exacerbate things?
Well, I certainly don't like what I saw in the most recent event involving the Prime Minister and the delegate from Italy. To allow those protesters up onto the steps and into that venue and the way they basically collapsed the security efforts, to me, was totally inappropriate, and better action needs to be taken in regards to that to protect our politicians.
But the argument might be, or would be, from some people that, you know what, it's the right to protest. And if you get involved, if the police do move in to clear this out, that you're going to end up with a much bigger mess. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. There certainly has to be like a tempered approach on the behalf of the police. But to allow something like that to happen And to really disrupt basically two heads of state and to get that close to the politicians involved and to allow that kind of collapse of security to me is not appropriate at all. And there needs to be better planning on the security side of it. But also at some point, enough is enough. And I would think that law enforcement will start taking some action on some of these.
Does not doing anything time after time after time, and it's been a long time, as I said, I mean, the time when I was down at Royal York was probably 3 months ago now, something like that. I mean, it's been almost daily. Does all of this embolden the protesters to know or at least to believe that nothing is ever going to be done?
It could be. I can't get into their mindset too much, but certainly, like I've seen them down in Toronto myself, up Yonge Street and whatnot. And when I saw the one going to Yonge Street, I thought it was a fairly measured approach. They let them move along. They went, they moved along pretty peacefully. They're loud and whatnot, but there's no violence or anything like that, so you let it happen. But to get involved in the type of intimidation I saw at the venue involving the Prime Minister, to me, is a different level. And when it starts getting into things like that, even like the shutdown of the highways and the intimidation of the people around there, you do have to start taking some action and set up your security better than what I've seen in this most recent event.
Well, that was the other thing that I was going to say, and I understand your point exactly about, you know, the Prime Minister and an official dignitary, you have to look after them. But I think there's a lot of people maybe who belong to synagogues or Jewish communities on Avenue Road and other places who would say, why is it just the Prime Minister who should be protected? We're being threatened and intimidated here too.
Yeah, the only thing I would say that the ones that involved the synagogues weren't to the extent I saw yesterday in the media. I might be wrong on some of that, but certainly if it's like that, right up onto the steps, not prohibiting people from going in and whatnot, that's a level that needs to be dealt with for sure.
One more thing, and I know you've heard this. I know a lot of people have heard this. Some listening may have said this, that we saw a different response to the trucker protest in Ottawa that was certainly affecting people than we have to this. Is there a comparison at all?
No, I don't think the two are that similar to make that kind of comparison. The trucker protest was fixed in place for a number of weeks and really disrupted the downtown like on a continuous basis to the point where the police actually moved in and cleaned them all out of there. I do think there's enough difference between the two that I don't think it's a direct comparison.
We got to run, but if, and I'm touching all the wood I can find and crossing my fingers and hoping and praying this doesn't happen, but if any of these ever accelerate and someone gets hurt or worse as a result of one of these protests, and nobody wants that or anything remotely close to it, will it be a fair thing to point the finger at police and say, you allowed this to get to this point?
Well, there's always criticism to be had. I think right now they're still looking at that measured approach. I think that's to some degree might come to an end at some point here. But I do think if I were in the police shoes, I'd be looking at targeting the main agitators and see if I could lay criminal charges on them and start arresting them outside of these protests, but start bringing them in the courts and do something about it.
That is Sean Sparling. He's retired deputy chief of Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently president of Investigative Solutions Network. Sean, thank you for the time today.
Great. Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
We got to go. That is our time for today. A quick nod, by the way, before I forget, quick nod to the late, great John Candy. Died 30 years ago today. One of the all-time greats, Canadian or otherwise, one of the all-time greats. Thank you for being here today. Really appreciate it. Scott Thompson, the other Scott, will be back tomorrow in this spot. Be here for that. Thank you to Ben. Thank you to Will for lining everything up. Thank you to all of our callers and participants and those who voted on the X poll. You've got 3 minutes if you want to jump in and give your thought on how Hamilton's done communicating about the cyber attack, and then the poll closes. So hurry up and do that. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great night.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.